Greetings, welcome back. Good afternoon for those of you in the West Coast, East Coast time zones. So far, just a quick recap here. So far in the earlier modules today, we introduced you to what we're doing with Java on Azure in general at Microsoft. And then I covered some of the tools. I showed you the sample app, and I showed you some of the code that you use to build the sample app and some of the services that you would actually use to build that code. So in this afternoon's sessions, we're going to talk more about where you actually put your code and then where how you would actually deploy it. So you've got code, you've been working on your workstation. How do you actually get it out to Azure to take advantage of all these services? As we mentioned before, one of the nice things is, you know, you can run code locally, still connecting to the services in the cloud, and then you can move it out to, in this case, a cloud service, which is also running in the cloud, and you shouldn't really notice any difference in performance, except maybe sort of better scaling than it worked on your workstation. So for this session, for this module, we're going to talk about Azure roles. We're going to talk about cloud service toolkits, and we're going to talk about service definitions and ANT scripts that are a new feature of the Eclipse toolkit. So, and actually, so a little bit about Azure roles. I mentioned worker roles, and I told you that we'd be talking about it later. So this is now when we're going to be talking about it. So the idea here is, we mentioned this as well. You've got IaaS, PaaS, and you've got software as a service. So any kind of packaged software you've got in your enterprise, you've got all of these items that are on the left. Every single one of these pieces is an important part of your application, an important part of your performance. Now, when you move out to the cloud, you've got basically three different options. Infrastructure as a service, and you've got everything from the OS on up that you manage as your infrastructure as a service platform. And then you've got your, actually I shouldn't say infrastructure as a service platform. Infrastructure as a service, virtual machine. And then platform as a service, you've got everything from the middleware on up that you manage. In this case, your Tomcat server, your JDK runtime, any data you have and any applications. And then we have software as a service, which is at the other end of the spectrum, which is basically Outlook Online or something like that, where you actually have everything controlled. You can configure certain things in it, but you really don't have any control of the application itself. The application itself is actually running on top of everything else, but you have certain leeway with configurations, but not as much as you do with platform as a service or infrastructure as a service. So that's basically the three different options you have. And today we're going to be talking about the middle tier, platform as a service, which is roles. So I mentioned roles before. Roles are a hosted service, and the idea here, if you think about it, it's sort of like a grouping. So you can have a certain configuration of a role, and you can scale out that role configuration with instances. So on the left here, the left box, we have roles defined as a hosted service. On the right is your instances. Each role will actually execute one or more instances. So in our case, we've got a very simple example where we have one worker role containing one instance. But you could have 10, 20 instances in a role. And we'll show you what we mean by that.
I think that the best analogy here with the sort of on-premises world, the traditional world, is that a role is analogous to a cluster or a tier of an application. So if you're putting a tier of an application in a cluster, you can think of that cluster as a unit. You can scale it up and down, and that's what a role is in Azure.
Yeah, but it's not a physical cluster. It's actually more like a logical cluster.
It's a virtual
cluster.
One.
It's a virtual cluster. So that's important to think about. It's not like a cluster in the sense that you got a bunch of physical machines connected together. You've got a bunch of virtual services connected together in this case. And the roles all look the same. The instances all look the same inside that role, and they can just scale. That's the power of it. So what else can run? What actually can run on on Azure roles. Basically, if it runs on Windows, you can run it on Azure roles. You can use different languages. You don't have to. You're not limited to .NET or C Sharp. You can use Java, C++, PHP, Node, et cetera, et cetera. We have all those JDKs you can use as well. And we have a choice of frameworks. So there's a number of frameworks you can use as well on top of the roles themselves. So the idea, why do we have roles? Why are they there? And the idea is that there is a scaling advantage to working with the role concept. From the top down of this diagram, basically we have a network load balancer, so traffic manager, something like that, that would actually route traffic intelligently. If one traffic route is getting busy, we can add more. Then from there we've got, and this is an important concept, the roles themselves, the worker roles, are stateless. The instances inside them are stateless as well. So the actual roles are there to handle scaling and scalability. And the actual persistence and the actual state you want to manage in your applications in the systems is basically at a different tier. So down at the bottom here, you've got some examples here of the places you want to put tiers, state tier. So that could be a storage, Azure storage. You can put persistence in queues. Queues will store persistent values, key value data stores, partition, relational databases, or just on a file system.
Yeah, and I think to just maybe clarify a little bit the statelessness of a role. I guess stateless may be too strong of a word. It's not durable in the sense that if that role instance goes down, and it could at any moment. I mean, Azure could intentionally take it down and move it to another data center, or it could just go down because of some error or whatever. The point is that the data that's stored on that instance locally by your application is not durable. You cannot count on it surviving that sort of a role instance recycle. So they're stateless in that sense, but it doesn't mean that you cannot have temporary state on them. I mean, you can still do caching, you can still have sessions, user sessions in HTTP. So it's not, I want to clarify that the statelessness is not purely, it's not in a strict sense of the word, but it's got more about the it's got more to do with the persistence and the durability of that state.
Yeah, that's a good example. So let's say that that there is a scheduled maintenance. Let's say we need to upgrade the operating system for an entire data center. In the case of these instances inside of roles, you could bring down one instance, update it, and then bring it back up while all the other instances are running. They're still managing your application, but you don't necessarily have to have any loss from bringing down that instance and bringing it back up because it was stateless.
Yeah, and that concept creates a certain design requirement for your applications. Which I think is overall a good design requirement for any sort of a environment. You want to architect your applications in such a way that that they store their state outside. You don't want to mess with the local machine necessarily, but you do want to architect this application so that it goes into a database or some sort of a storage outside of that actual instance. It's important to kind of keep in mind when you're developing cloud applications that are targeted at the platform as a service or cloud services in Azure to keep that in mind, basically.
So I'm going to show you an example here, just a little example of caching as a role versus instance sample that we can show you. So caching, we have a caching service on Azure. It's low latency, it's in memory. You can dynamically grow and shrink a cache. And it's highly available, obviously. That's the whole point of caching. Let's just start with this. So we've got this worker role. This is a worker role, basically. There's four instances in the worker role. Each one of those instances has 300 megs of caching, okay, on each instance. So on the actual cloud service instance, there's 300 megs each. And that basically makes it 1.2 gigs of distributed cache. So anytime that you need to do any processing, bring one of these down, the cache can pick up from another instance as well. So let's say we want to actually add some caching as a service on top of the worker role. So there's a worker role up there. It's still got the 1.2 gigs of distributed cache, but now we're adding caching as a service. It's one of our Azure services, and we're adding two instances, two role instances. So now we've got worker role one, which is our actually application instances, actual application instances. Then we've got worker role two, which is our caching instances. And we only need two instances for caching. So we've got a lot of caching going on here now in the worker role one and worker role two. Yeah.
So I think this is a great example sort of a pattern where you have a dedicated cache that is running in its own role, in its own cluster, that's scalable independently of your actual application tier.
Yeah.
And the application tier is sort of, you know, basically a different role. So this is sort of an alternative to having the cache distributed across the instances that are running your applications, which was the first picture that we showed. So you have either a co-located cache, like the first one, or a dedicated cache, like that second pattern.
Yeah, and the beauty of this is any one of these role instances for caching can point at any one of these worker roles for the application. I'm sorry, role instances for the application. So right now we've got two. You can scale that out to four, and it doesn't affect your application. You don't have to bring down the application to add the other two cache.
And we can think of this particular example as an example of a pattern where it's not the caching, maybe it's something else that you have in your deployment that should be separated out into a separate tier, a separate cluster. So that's just an example of that, how you can have a relationship between two different roles and scale them independently. And both of those roles are part of the same cloud service, part of the same deployment, basically.
Yeah. So that's worker roles and instances in a nutshell. So now we're going to talk about deploying applications to worker roles. And to do that, we're going to show off some cloud service toolkits that we have. Martin showed you at the very beginning of module one, a way to just deploy things from Eclipse quickly to Azure. And now we're going to actually show
you. Let's pick up from there. So if you remember, we did this in the morning. I just showed you a quick preview, a very quick and dirty way of just deploying an application, Java application, into Azure, the quickest way I could think of, right? So going back to that application now, this is the state we left it in. So we had that Hello World application. We had it already published on Azure in a simple way. And I've already done some cleanup, and I've unpublished it since then. What has actually happened behind the scenes? This will give us a chance to look at the more sort of advanced and the richer features of the Azure Toolkit for Eclipse. So when we did this, when we published this application, one of the questions that we were asked was about what JDK we want to use and what application server we want to use. What happened behind the scenes when we said, well, okay, here's, I just want to publish, just go for it. The toolkit actually created what is called an Azure deployment project for you behind the scenes. So this is the item here in the Project Explorer. It's automatically named basically My Hello World on Azure, and it's an Azure deployment project. So this is the vehicle for taking your application or multiple applications. I mean, you could have multiple application deployments on the same server or multiple roles with different servers and a whole bunch of applications. So the project, the Azure deployment project is the shell that carries your payload. It carries your Java workload. So the Azure project itself is not Java specific in the sense that it doesn't have any Java code. You don't write code in the Java Azure deployment project. You write your Java application independently, and then you just package it inside of an Azure deployment project. So this deployment project was created for us automatically. We could have started from scratch by creating a new project first and then adding applications to it. So if you look at the toolbar here, one of the items here is one of the buttons is New Azure Deployment Project. So we could have started with a completely different wizard, which gives you a chance of configuring your project from scratch. So let me just quickly walk through that wizard just to show you the kinds of things that you would be able to configure here. So one of the first things that the wizard is asking you about is the JDK. What JDK do you want to use? And you get a choice. Well, so you could have custom steps where you don't want the toolkit to deploy any JDK, because maybe you have your own custom step somewhere in your startup script which deployed either their own JDK, or maybe it's not even a Java deployment. I've seen people who are using our tools that are sort of designed for Java, but they're using them to deploy Node, for example. I've seen that happen. So, but normally you would basically choose either between this third-party JDK package that's already available on Azure. So we have a number of packages based on the OpenJDK from Azul Systems available on Azure already for you. So you don't have to upload, you don't have to do any of that. So you just pick your own version and we basically maintain this list. Or you could point at your own custom download of a JDK distribution. So if you have, for example, you know, a contract or a license for an Oracle JDK or something like that, then you would upload it on your own and just put the URL here. And if it's in your storage account, which it probably would be, then we would sort of figure out how to get it, how to fetch it, and how to deploy it. So all that logic is kind of built in into the toolkit itself. So normally, if you're just playing around, if we're getting started, you would just pick one of these here from the third-party JDKs and just be done with that part. And then the next thing that you set up is the application server. So again, in that first demo that I showed you, we just accepted the defaults, which basically meant there was some Tomcat server distribution V8 update 20 or something like that. But if you really are picky about your server, then this is the wizard that gives you the opportunity to choose exactly which server you want, and you get choices beyond Tomcat and Jetty. In fact, you can even do JBoss. You can do a whole bunch of different ones. So let me just show you a quick preview of that. So if I were to use a server, I could also deploy a server for my own machine if I wanted to. I could do that. So let me just go to my some sort of a distribution. I guess I just have on this particular machine, I just have Tomcat, if I'm not mistaken. Let me just see. But I could also do.
One of the things I should mention is the reason why you want to actually deploy from a location other than your local workstation is partly for bandwidth and performance and it just package size. So if you use a JDK that's already out in Azure Storage and you use a Tomcat server that's already out in Azure Storage or out on the cloud somewhere via URL or something like that, the package that you're going to create with this deployment is going to be much smaller, yep, and easier to transport, easier to distribute.
And it's not so much the package itself, because nothing really gets packaged in the single file that your applications are uploaded with. But it's uploaded separately. But it's uploaded only once. So even if you pick your own custom server from your desktop machine, the toolkit is still smart about uploading it only once, and basically caching it in your storage account. So anyway, so I have Tomcat here, and if I pick that, we discover that it's Tomcat 8, and I could have chosen any one of these other servers, Tomcat, any version of Tomcat, between 6 and 8. I could have chosen Glassfish, I could have chosen Liberty, JBoss, or Jetty. These are the ones that the Eclipse toolkit already knows about. It knows how to deploy them under the hood without you having to specify that startup logic and deployment logic. So as long as you use one of those, then we help you along. But you are free to use pretty much anything that can be run on Windows. There is no restrictions. It's just that if you're using something that the toolkit is not aware of, then you would have to provide your own custom steps for deploying that that particular piece of software. So that's basically what that is about. And again, here we have a similar choice. Like in the JDK, I could either deploy that locally installed server, or I could just choose one of the servers available on Azure. In this case, because I already picked Tomcat locally, the only choice I get in Azure is a compatible version of Tomcat. So we don't want to create a situation where you're kind of referencing one version of Tomcat or one version of a server locally, but a different version in the cloud. That gets a little bit unstable. But if I were to just say I'm not going to deal with local servers at all I want is a cloud server, then you see the list of choices that we make available for you already in Azure. So again, you could use more servers than that, but these are so far the ones that we make available directly in Azure, so it's faster to deploy or whatnot. And again, just like in the case of the JDK, you could have selected a custom download, but for that one, in the current logic of the toolkit, I would have to specify my local deployment so that we would know what this URL actually points at. So that option actually becomes available if I were to specify my local server. And then at the end, the last step is basically just your application. So I actually need to specify a server here.
Yeah, the sticky sessions.
And then we get the application. So this is the point at which you can add other WAR files, other applications, and you can add them either by a reference to the WAR file itself, or you could add a reference to a project. If it's in the same workspace, then the toolkit knows how to, I mean, it kind of guesses how to build your project, and it builds it on demand when it needs to, and then it includes the WAR file automatically. So that those are the two choices that you have. So, and all of this is re-entrant. So I'm actually going to cancel out of this because the project that was already created for me, the deployment project, I could change all that information in that project as well. That information, the JDK and the application server, is associated with an individual role. So like I mentioned before, the roles are your clusters, your different application tiers. So you are free to deploy different servers, different pieces of software to different roles within the same cloud service. And I don't know how common that pattern is to have more than, you know, a couple of roles, but certainly that's one of the strengths, that's one of the benefits of using cloud services, that it offers you that ability to design more complex multi-tier deployments with all kinds of networking and all kinds of business logic kind of distributed across the deployment. So if I look at the worker role itself in this node, if I right-click on it, that's basically my entry point to a whole bunch of features that we enable on top of your project. And if I just look at the server configuration feature, you will recognize this is just a way to re-enter that original configuration for the JDK and the server, so you can change it later. You can change it. So in fact, you know, this is where I can see that, okay, so the toolkit picked Zulu OpenJDK 1.8 for me originally, but if I want to use something else, I can switch to it right now. And I can say, no, actually, I want 1.7. And from this point on, this 1.7 version will be used. And same thing with the server. So again, this was picked for me automatically, but I could say, no, actually, I prefer Jetty. And the toolkit implements a certain sort of abstraction around the servers that allows you to change the servers without really worrying about your applications or without worrying about how you set up your HTTPS using the toolkit or how you set up your sticky sessions. The servers are sort of a black box to the toolkit. The toolkit just knows, here's how I deployed Tomcat, here's how I deployed Jetty. But other than that, they're a black box to me. So that's kind of how you want to think about these different server deployments. So let's cancel out of that. Let's look at some other things that you can do with the project. And this is the entry point properties is basically the entry point to all these other features. So you can just expand that menu and go through them quickly here. I'm not going to try to like play with these because it could take a little bit of time, but I'll at least show you what is possible. So caching, this is the example that Brian mentioned earlier, where the toolkit helps you set up co-located caching out of the box. Dedicated caching is more involved. We have a tutorial on that. But co-located caching is just a checkbox. You just click a checkbox and a cache is created for you automatically. And it's a memcached compatible cache. So if you have a memcached client, for example, Spy Memcached is one of the standard ones that people are using, then you can connect to that co-located distributed cache through that client. It's a Java client. So that's caching. Another one. So certificates really only make sense on Windows. I'm going to skip that. That's not too interesting. Components is a more advanced feature. This is where actually, if you play around with these different JDK settings, different application server settings, you will notice that what they actually get translated into are these components. And components are just a lower level of a lower type of abstraction in the toolkit that describe the setup, the deployment steps associated with these higher level concepts such as a JDK or a server. So once you get a little bit more sophisticated, you could customize your deployment by using this components UI and basically do more sophisticated types of logic to these components. So maybe there's a specific zip file that you want to download from somewhere as part of your startup logic. So that's what you could configure through a component. Maybe there's a startup command that you want to run. That's another type of component that you would add. So that's a more sophisticated kind of a way to design the logic of the deployment logic of your project. Debugging. So this is what enables you to configure remote debugging for your Java application. And again, it's a single checkbox. There is a lot of this single checkbox philosophy across our toolkit. And that's really the idea. We really wanted to make things simple so that getting things done, such as setting up remote debugging or caching or other things, it's really trivial. You don't have to think about it too hard. You just worry about your application logic, and everything else is hopefully a matter of a checkbox somewhere. And of course, there are ways to customize these settings further, but if you just accept the defaults, then most of the time it's just a question of clicking a checkbox. Endpoints is just a way to define your port routing. So Azure by default is firewalled. Your deployments are heavily firewalled, so they're secure that way. So you have to create your own sort of whitelist, so to speak, of ports that you want to open up to the outside world. And the public ports are automatically load balanced. So the endpoints give you a way to map public ports, which are load balanced, to private ports, which are distributed across instances of a particular role. So if you have a Tomcat role, for example, so by default, Tomcat listens on port 8080, but the default HTTP port to the outside world is port 80. So an endpoint would be, so here's an example of an endpoint that's predefined by default, where the public port is 80 and the private port is 8080. And you can define other endpoints, but you have to declare them explicitly. If your application is expecting some traffic on endpoint, I don't know, 8090 or something like that, then you want to add that endpoints explicitly to this list so that Azure opens up that part of the firewall. Another thing is environment variables. So that's another thing where you will notice that there's a lot of automated kind of pre-generated settings for you as part of declaring your application servers and your Java runtimes, and you can use your own.
Yeah, you can write application-specific environment variables. In fact, what I want to tell you here is we are using Log4j in the sample application. And if you want to specify where you want log output files to be put, you would actually add a Log4j environment variable in here. It's in the README in the GitHub project, but this is exactly where you would plug in your environment variable that tells you where you want to write logs to.
And this brings me to one caveat that you kind of want to remember. Your deployment will run on a Windows machine, regardless of where you offer it. You could deploy from the Mac, like I am here, or from Linux, like Ubuntu, for example, or from Windows. But ultimately, all these deployments are going to be running in a cloud service that is running on top of a Windows virtual machine. Now, usually, most of the time, that doesn't mean anything. It doesn't manifest. The operating system doesn't really manifest itself all that much, except for a couple of places like this one, where the environment variables actually have to be expressed or represented as Windows environment variables using the Windows syntax. So that's one of those sort of Windows-isms. That Windows-isms, is that a word? I don't know. Now it is. Yeah. I just declared it a word, but that's how it works. So that's something to keep in mind. But again, this is just Java you're running. So presumably, the operating system is just. It doesn't really matter. Another feature here that comes in useful quite a bit is HTTP sticky sessions, session affinity. So a little bit of background on that. Windows Azure, by default, the load balancer in Windows Azure, and sorry, the new name is Azure,
Microsoft.
Not Windows, Microsoft Azure. I am still used to the old name, the Windows Azure, right?
I still call it once.
It's just the, bad habits die. What is the saying?
They die hard.
So they die hard. They die hard, right? So the load balancer in Azure it doesn't support sticky sessions on its own. It's kind of blind. I mean, it just always distributes traffic across your role instances. So if a given role declared that it's handling port 80. Then the load balancer will be just randomly distributed. I mean, it has its own rules, but it will be, you cannot control that directly yourself, where your traffic is going to go, which of the instances, which are really clones of each other, which of these instances the traffic is going to go to. But in some situations, which are very common in Java scenarios, you do want session stickiness, because especially in a situation where you don't really want to set up a replicated cache, which maybe, you know, there may be performance reasons, there may be replication, just complexity reasons. Setting up a replicated cache can be a hassle, so a simple workaround is just to stick with sticky sessions. How do you achieve sticky sessions in Azure, where the load balancer is fundamentally not aware of session stickiness? Well, we've solved this problem through the toolkit by installing some software behind the scenes. And again, much in the spirit of the single click philosophy, all you have to do is click on the checkbox, and sticky sessions become enabled for your particular deployment for a particular port. I mean, these are endpoints. They're associated with a specific endpoint. But it's literally a checkbox. And if you were to try to do this on your own without the Eclipse toolkit or the Azure toolkit for Eclipse, you would see just how much you would have to do to get that to work. And we kind of had to describe, our lawyers actually told us we have to describe what it is that we're doing here behind the scenes. But but that's the simplicity. That was one of the biggest value adds of going through the toolkit, that we just do this for you automatically.
Yeah, so the idea is when you're actually building the sessions or sticky sessions, if you have four instances in your role, 1, 2, 3, 4, and a user comes into role three or instance three in that role, they'll stay on instance three just to maintain application session persistence.
So that
for that moment.
Partials, that temporary state that you want to maintain on that machine, you've already logged that user in. You know who that user is. So you want to maintain that session for a while. So that's what sticky sessions enables you to do. Because then every time that user sends another web request to your application, even though the load balancer is going to redirect it to some random role instance, but each of those role instances is smart enough to redirect that traffic to the correct role instance, and that's basically how it's implemented behind the scenes. But again, it's hidden from you. You just have a checkbox to click.
Yeah.
So local storage—that's kind of a concept in these roles where. So by default, if you don't declare any local storage, what you get is this thing called the approot. So the approot is just a directory on your virtual disk that gets created in each of your role instances. The approot is of a limited size. I think it's like 1 or so gigabytes, 1.5 gigabytes. I mean, it sounds big, but it's when you start deploying things like JDKs and JBoss and whatnot, then you run out of space. You can run out of space. The idea behind local storage is that it's a way to define a directory. It shows up as a directory basically on your virtual machine out there, which is of a specific size. So you declare the size in this configuration UI, and that's basically, you know, you could put the size here, whatever I want. If my deployment requires 4 gigabytes, then I just say it's a multiple of megabytes. So I guess it's 4096 or something like that. And that gives me 4 gigabytes. So then I'm guaranteed that I'm actually going to get 4 gigabytes in that particular storage account. And then I can reference that, sorry, not storage account, local storage is different from storage accounts. And then I can reference that particular directory using an environment variable, because the directory name is actually not preset. It's not predictable. It's a random GUID, actually. But the environment variable here is going to be the one that you're going to be referencing. You can reference from your scripts, you can reference from your application to figure out where is that big directory that I have set up for my 4 gigabyte deployment. So that's just another way of taking advantage of those local storage resources. Now, those local storage resources are still temporary. In some sense, they're a little bit more durable than just your default approot disk, because you can specify whether you want to clean the contents when the instance is recycled, or if you want to preserve the contents. But they're not durable in the sense, it's not like a virtual disk attached to your virtual machine that will preserve your data forever. That's not how these local storages work. So it's more for just declaring a certain amount of size on your local disk and kind of being able to take advantage of that. So we already talked about server configuration, how you can change your JDKs and application servers. And the last thing to point out on this one is what we call SSL offloading. Now, the term SSL offloading, I'm not sure if it's the most accurate term to use in this context, but the idea is that, and again, a single checkbox, the idea is that if you have your Tomcat, let's say, configured to listen to port 8080 for its regular HTTP traffic, well, for you to configure Tomcat to listen to 443 or whatever you want to use for HTTPS, there's configuration. There's some Tomcat-specific configuration that you need to do. If you're using JD, there's JD-specific configuration. It's an application server-specific configuration. So for us, since we want to be able to treat each server as a black box, we came up with this concept of basically offloading the HTTPS, this SSL handling, so that your specific application server is not even aware of it, but instead there is another layer. It's actually implemented using Microsoft IIS server, which is completely transparent, but it does the actual handling of HTTPS if you configure this feature using this using the toolkit here. So SSL offloading in this case simply means that your 443 traffic, your SSL traffic, is going to go through IIS. IIS is going to do all the heavy lifting of decrypting and basically, and then it passes it on to your Tomcat or JD or whatnot on its regular HTTP port. So it's 8080 or whatever it is. So your Java application server actually doesn't have to be aware of the fact that this traffic originated as HTTPS. So you get sort of, you can achieve HTTPS handling in a very easy, very simple way without having to think about it yourself right. at all. And so the application is oblivious to it as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't have to build any actual SSL handling into your Java application. You could if you want, but you don't have to. You click the box instead, and you have SSL built in and it's running. If you want to actually have, and it's the same thing for the Tomcat server. So there is ways, plugins, add-ons, code libraries to actually enable SSL on Tomcat as well. But you don't need those. All you can do is click this box, and you've got SSL handled on the front end, and everything else behind the scenes, your app server, can just be the way it were before without actually having to alter them to build in SSL.
Yeah. Another big important piece of metadata about your role is the actual size of the virtual machines that you want to use for your instances. So that's what you declare on this top level here. So you can say small, or there are various sizes, and these sizes, they have specific names in Azure, but the names are associated with a specific combo of RAM, CPU power, and some other things. But that's on that basis, you basically choose your virtual machine size, and there's different pricing for different things. So depending on how much power you want, you get to choose that. And by default, it's small. It's just it's not extra. You don't want to use extra small because extra small is shared with other tenants, so it's probably not going to do all that well with any sort of a heavy-duty Java server. But small is a pretty good starting point.
So to get an idea of those sizes and the pricing and everything, if you just search on Azure pricing, it'll bring you to a page which describes every one of those configurations in a table, and you can pick which one is right for you.
And the last thing to control here is the number of instances for any given role. So this is basically this is the initial setting. You can change it later after your deployment is already working in Azure. But this is the initial setting, which basically says when I'm deploying it, how many instances of that role should Azure create before the whole thing goes online. So by default, we use one because that's the cheap one for death test scenarios. One is enough. But of course, for production and to get the SLA associated with Azure, two is the minimum. That's what gives you the high availability and the whole power of the cloud. But one is the starting point for developer scenarios. And again, you can change it later after you deploy. You can just change it, sort of say, okay, now I'm expecting big traffic tomorrow, so let me increase it to 10 or something like that. So that's how you can do it both through the toolkit as well as through the Azure portal. So that's what you get to control on the individual roles. And by default, you just get one role per project, but you can add other roles. And the way you add other roles is by going to project properties. So on the project level, if you go to, again, right-click menu, Azure, and then you will see, add role is right there, so you can add another role just from there. Or you can just go to project properties and see what's on the project level. So at the very top, you get the interesting one is the target OS, or semi-interesting at least. And today, cloud services support these three OSs, Windows servers, basically. You can also, if you are on Windows, and this is something, unfortunately, we can't get to work on the Mac yet, but you would be able to configure your remote access, RDP-based remote access. And then your roles, this is where you can add another role to your deployment. So again, to distinguish instances versus roles, roles are entire clusters, whereas instances are the VMs within a role. So when you're adding a role, what that means is you're adding another tier to your application or another cluster in your application that has its own definition. So that's a distinction to keep in mind. And subscriptions is just an entry point to manage your subscriptions, which you get from the published settings file.
Now, I was going to say about remote access. It's a pretty cool feature in Windows. You can actually create, if you click that box and you put in a username and password, as soon as the role is created and published on the cloud service, it will actually open that server for you to look at the file system level in Azure. So it's a nice feature. It's from Windows right now. Obviously, there's challenges when you're talking about Mac and configuring a remote desktop services to Windows.
So now that we've gone through all the major features of an Azure deployment project, now you can see how we took a shortcut by basically accepting all the defaults originally. But now I've taken you on this big detour going through all the different features that you can configure. So the point here is that you can start simple and quick and then configure it arbitrarily if you want, I mean, depending on how much complexity you want to get into. So the way to achieve that complexity is by editing the deployment project itself. Now, what happens at the end of the day when you build this, when you publish this, is the same thing. You're just using, so what we're using is an Ant extension behind the scenes. And that is shared across our Eclipse toolkit, our IntelliJ toolkit, and I'll show you later in a later session how to hook it up to Jenkins as well. But the Ant extension that ships as part of the toolkit has all the logic for building these things as Azure packages and publishing them into Azure Cloud Services. So if I were to basically, I clicked the publish to button, publish to cloud button on my Java project directly. That was just a shortcut way. But normally, once you're in this more advanced scenario, you would just select your Azure project itself, and then same feature, just click publish to cloud, and that will do all that logic of deploying it, and you will see the output of the Ant task in the console window. It takes usually a few minutes.
And you can show them package.xml there.
Yeah, so I guess I'll get a little bit more into this later. But So when I talk about Ant, obviously Ant requires a configuration or a build file. So package.xml, which is a file inside of your Azure deployment project, that's the one that has all the smarts, all the information that is needed for deploying and for building your cloud service. So there's a lot of stuff we could theoretically talk about. We're not going to get into all this detail even later. But at least I'll show you how you can use this in scenarios outside of Eclipse where you just want to take it out and you just want to automate it, basically, through Jenkins or through command line tools. So you can do that actually now. Yeah. You don't have to. You can use Eclipse for your occasional tweaking some properties. Gives you an easier way to tweak some deployment settings. Also, it gives you an easy way to get started with a project. But once you have it figured out, for repetitive deployments, continuous integration scenarios, obviously you don't want to just be clicking in Eclipse all the time. You want to put it in some sort of automated tooling. So that's what's enabled by this. And we're going to get into more of that in our module 6, I believe.
Module 6, yeah.
That's right.
Yep.
So yeah, I think that's basically it for the toolkit for now.
Great. The other toolkit I wanted to show you was the IntelliJ toolkit. So this is IntelliJ. I fired it up. I'm not going to go into a lot of details because I'll just be repeating things that Martin had mentioned. But I've got a quick little web project here in IntelliJ. And the same thing, if I click on the package for Azure, very familiar interface here now. If I click on Next, I get the JDK server applications. If I click on Next, I get the session affinities. If I click Finish, it's going to create that deployment project for me, just like it would here. Now, the features are not at parity with this one.
Yet.
Eclipse has a few more features, and it has multi-platform support, which this one doesn't have.
But it's a temporary. Yeah. We're basically, yeah. IntelliJ is a work in progress for us. We just started in last October, whereas Eclipse has been going on for over 4 years. So that's the only difference. But ultimately, the idea is that IntelliJ and Eclipse will have the same parity in terms of its functionality.
Yep. So if you're using IntelliJ instead of Eclipse, we have tools available, and they'll be at parity soon. This is a plugin, just like it is for Eclipse. You install the plugin, and you can do most of what you want to do to get this out to Azure as well.
And again, what's underlying all this is the same shared code logic, the Ant extension, and basically it's all the same. It's just a different wrapper, different IDE, but the insides are shared across Eclipse and IntelliJ.
Yeah, and speaking of that, so what's in there that actually deploys things to Azure? Service definitions is what you have that are actually being deployed out to Azure. And they just describe the shape. So there's a service definition, there's a service package. The package itself, actually, here's what it is. So service configuration. So service definition says what kind of service are we deploying. The service configuration tells us in that service what should be contained, where should it go, things like that. So people are familiar in the Java world with the concept of WAR files, where you have a containing application with a number of libraries and a configuration that goes in certain places when you actually deploy it out to an app server. It's the same sort of idea. It's not the same at all, but it's the same sort of idea in terms of you package up, okay, what should this actual cloud service target look like, and then what should be in that cloud service target? And it's zipped and packaged much the way a WAR file is, and the Azure service consumes it, runs it, sets it up the way you've instructed
now,
it.
One thing I would want to, one word of caution, I guess I want to share about the CSDef and CSConfig files. So the point of the tools that we're developing for the IDEs is to give you a user-friendly UI that lets you configure things, configure different things on a higher level of abstraction, and the tooling itself translates that into the proper changes in the CSDef and CSConfig files. So the CSDef and CSConfig files, ultimately, that's where all this information is going. But so what I mean by that is that unless you're an advanced user and you know what you're doing, I wouldn't recommend messing with CSDef and CSConfig manually. I would just start off by relying on the UI to do the right thing in there. But once you get really familiar with Azure's configuration, how to mess with the XML directly, you know, at that point, you're kind of feel free to change it manually. But that's the point of the UI, to kind of make that easier and sort of reduce the opportunity for error and things like that.
Right, exactly. So we have tools that can do that for you. And as we as Martin highlighted, you know, we have Apache Ant script generation now that does not replace the CS pack and the CS def files, but it uses those in a new way using Apache Ant to actually deploy those out to Azure. So it generates the files and deploys them out to Azure based on instructions that are in the
package.xml.
Package.xml. And it uses an Ant script to call the package.xml, which calls the CFDefs and the CFDefs.
And we even, now that you actually mentioned that, we even went as far as pre-creating the script, the exact command line, just a single command line. But we went as far as pre-creating that command line for you in the project. So if we switch back to my computer here, I'll just point out where that is. After you build and publish your project, you see this cloud tools directory, and underneath it, you have both the Windows and Linux Mac versions of that script. Now, it's a very trivial script. All it is just ants and pointing at the package.xml, but makes it sort of super obvious what's actually happening under the hood, and publishes basically the target. So if you look at the package.xml file, there's a published target which does all the logic of building and publishing. So it's really that simple. So I mean, if you really sort of don't want to mess with it yourself manually too much, then just run this script and it will redo all the logic that the Eclipse toolkit is doing just without the Eclipse toolkit.
So that's it for this module. We've covered Azure Roles. We've talked about the toolkits for Eclipse and for IntelliJ, and given you a little info on service definitions and Ant. Next up is Chris Reisner, who's going to show us websites, Azure websites, Java, how to run Java on Azure websites. And then we're going to have a session on some of our DevOps and continuous integration tools. And that's probably, I'm guessing, it's going to be a half-hour session.
And we're going to pick up from where we left off here as far as the automation goes. So we're going to pick up, in the Jenkins demo that I showed at the beginning today in the morning. We're going to go a little bit deeper into that to see how I can leverage this stuff from Ant and from Eclipse, how I can easily leverage that in a Jenkins build job and just completely automate the whole thing from scratch. So that's what we will cover in the last module.
Yep.
All right.
That's it. Thank you.